This KABU program has been made possible in part by the KABU Foundation members and a grant from Gazelle Natural Fiber Clothing, featuring 100% natural fiber clothing for women and men. Real clothing for real people. Proud to sponsor the important voice of KABU. Gazelle is located at Northeast 41st and Fremont and can be reached at 503-288-3422.
Hello everyone. KABU, your community radio station, invites you to tune in Sunday, May 21st from noon to 7 p.m. We will be broadcasting live from Pecun headquarters in Woodburn, Oregon with music and interviews. KABU is partnering with Pecun and the Woodburn community in their efforts to establish their own radio station. Pecun stands for Pineros y Campesinos Unidos del Noroeste. It is Oregon's largest Latino farm labor organization. Live music will be played by the bands Los Enemigos del Silencio, Gérmenes, and the Woodburn High School Mariachi Band. We will be talking with the women of Pecun, as well as musicians, artists, and other people from that community. We would like to invite you to become part of KABU and get involved in your community. We have opportunities for everyone. Remember to join us on Sunday, May 21st from noon to 7 p.m. on your community radio station KBOO 90.7 FM.
This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. This land was made for you and me.
Diamond desert, and all around me a voice was sounding.
This land was made for you and me.
Hey, good morning. Eddie.
Yo.
Whose land is this?
I don't know, but if I were you, I'd start learning Chinese.
That's the voice of Eddie Goldberg. I'm Marlena Smith. It's 5 minutes after the hour of 9. You're tuned to your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on the FM band, community-sponsored, non-corporate radio. Eddie, about This Land Is Your Land.
Yeah, Woody Guthrie's song from his most passionate days. Woody, of course, was the father of Arlo, but better known in his day as an itinerant hobo romantic folk singer and lefty. He had a sign pasted to his guitar that said, "This machine kills fascists."
Ah.
And he was a model and an inspiration for many, many people. You talked to Steve Earle, you talked to, well, Bob Dylan, certainly. Dylan went to see him when he was dying of Huntington's chorea in a hospital in New Jersey. He's been an inspiration for many, many people. That song, "This Land Was Made for You and Me," has been used by everybody, including at one point, I swear this is true, they had a pro-war march in New York in 1966 where war veterans and the American Legion and stuff were marching down the street, and there was a sound truck blasting this song, accompanying them as they went down the street. So anybody can appropriate the song. One verse seems to have been left out in the Kingston Trio version, though. It's about a guy coming to a beautiful field, and there's a sign on it that says no trespassing, but as Woody sings, on the other side it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me.
It's interesting, in the liner notes on the CD from Woody Guthrie, which we'll play now here in just a second so we can hear the other verse, it was written in February 1940 on the 23rd of February. Best known song and one of the most widely sung songs in the United States. It has even been championed as a new national anthem. Social significance lies in its inclusive statements, and its popularity is derived from a simple melody that can be sung by all. Shall we go to the second one that you brought out from the...
Yes, of course. And I will be deeply embarrassed if Whitta doesn't sing that verse in this version.
All right, let's see what happens.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway. Saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled, and I followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. All around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling. The voice was chanting, and the fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, and this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. When the sun comes shining, then I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, the dust clouds rolling, the voice coming chanting, fog was lifting, this land was made for you and me.
Well, there we have it. We don't have the...
we don't have the missing verse. Well, one thing I noticed listening to this song probably for the 10,000th time in my life is this song is the direct inspiration for maybe a half a dozen Dylan songs, and certainly for his whole career.
And I just want to remind people, the first version was the Kingston Trio version. And we're going to do some more with the Kingston Trio because,
What the hell? Why not?
I like them a lot.
I love them.
They introduced me to folk music.
Okay. All right, Eddie, let me give my Astro update, and we'll talk about politics. And I want to remind our listeners, at 10 o'clock, we should have Martine Prechtel here in the studio. Our friend Martine will be here to talk about a different way of thinking about what's going on. Eddie, hang on. Mm-hmm. Tomorrow the sun will go into Gemini. We're finishing the month of Taurus, which is the fecund, green, earthy, stable time of the year. We're going to move into Gemini tomorrow, which is an air sign, very mental, very changeable, curious, an increase in diversity. And reading from the Mountain Astrologer, new moons are no moons, and this new moon will be coming up next Friday, the 26th, though I thought it would be noteworthy, because new moons are always good times to begin planting, also in the garden. And by the way, this is the last week of the cycle, of the lunar cycle, and according to the planting guides, you don't do anything in the garden this last week. You just kind of leave it alone and let it just rest. But you can begin planting after next Friday. New moons are no moons. Only the faint light of the stars adorns the night sky. Once more, we're in the dark, ready to glimpse a new light. With the sun and the moon in Gemini, the first air sign, this new moon turns our attention toward the mental aspect of our being, how our thoughts color and shape our experience of life. Our mind, like the air, is something that many of us take for granted. We breathe, we think, and we're generally unconscious of our breathing and thinking. We notice that the quality of our breath corresponds to thoughts and perceptions of the world. The deeper our breath, the more present and receptive we are. The shallower, the more fearful and defensive. This new moon reminds us of the power of breath and the power of the mind. The myth of the twins, Castor and Pollux, depicts Gemini's spiritual journey and goal. Castor and Pollux are brothers, one is mortal, the other divine. In a quarrel with another set of twins, Castor is slain. The grieving Pollux appeals to Zeus, his father, who then permits them to take turns being in the upper and lower worlds, meeting once a day to share what they have learned. Thus, Gemini seeks to reconcile the polarities of heaven and earth, light and dark, reason and intuition, and to bridge seemingly disparate dimensions. Gemini's ruling planet Mercury echoes this theme as the mythic messenger of the gods, traveling freely between heaven, earth, and Hades, or the underworld. These represent the superconscious, the conscious, and the unconscious levels of the mind. Mercury is in the middle of his yearly transit through Gemini during this new moon, amplifying the cosmic message to lengthen our antennae and be receptive to new sources of information. The mythic messenger is squared by Uranus and Pisces, opening the doors of perception and encouraging us to think our way out of the box. Uranus, the first planet to be discovered after the traditional seven, is often considered the higher octave of Mercury, the first planet out from the sun. When Uranus and Mercury are in any aspect to each other, they short-circuit conventional thinking and they spark new insights. In mythology, Uranus is the god of creation as the husband of Gaia. He propagates new realities. With Uranus squaring the ruling planet of Gemini, this new moon invites us to be open to alternative ideas and to remember that truth is often stranger than fiction. My, my. Jupiter, the ruling planet of Sagittarius, the sign opposite Gemini, is in Scorpio, semi-squaring Pluto in Sagittarius, supporting the excavation of outdated concepts and conventions. Jupiter and Pluto continue to help us purge limited beliefs as they move through each other's sign until Jupiter goes into Sagittarius November 23rd. Pluto at 26 degrees of Sagittarius is quincunx Mars in Cancer, indicating that what we discover now may be disconcerting but necessary. The Sabian symbol for this new moon at 6 degrees Gemini suggests that valuable information awaits our persistence and willingness to get to the truth. Quote, workmen drilling for oil, the avidity for that knowledge which ensures wealth and power. Close quote. Interesting. This new moon changes mind over matter to mind is matter. What we think matters as much as what we say and what we do. The greatest revolution in our generation is that of human beings who, by changing the inner attitudes of their minds, can change the outer aspect of their lives. Well, Eddie, that sounds a lot like Jim Morrison.
It does.
Doesn't it?
Was he a Gemini?
I don't know. I'm wondering now. He was all about perception, the Doors.
Yeah. That took it from that Aldous Huxley book, The Doors of Perception.
Right.
That's where they got their name.
And aren't you a Gemini?
My birthday's Monday.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Does this resonate for you as a Gemini, this Pollux and Castor going from heaven to hell every day?
I don't know. I'm of two minds about that.
Well, Eddie, it's been an interesting month since you and I last spoke. And, of course, the big news, I think, right now, well, let's... yeah, let's go to the big news. General Hayden, General mm-hmm. Michael Hayden, the gentleman who oversaw the 911 failures as the head of the NSA, the guy who oversaw NSA, and yet we've caught nobody, the guy who has either by evasion, being guarded, or non-disclosing, is not admitting to anything, but has been responsible for, apparently, for some widespread wiretapping.
Yeah, you know, Hayden, talking about being of two minds, I look at Hayden from two angles. One is, strictly by resume, this guy is perfect for the job. He's been head of the NSA for a long time. He's had to work closely with the Director of Central Intelligence. He's had to work closely with Negroponte in the past. Side question, which doesn't have to be answered now. It's rhetorical. Why isn't Negroponte in jail for war crimes?
Good question.
So Hayden is a thorough professional in every way. He's worked with Democrats on the Intelligence Committee. The Democrats all like him. There is nothing they can do or nothing they can say in terms of his competence and his experience about to keep him off the CIA. Well, they can't do it anyway because it's whatever happens, it's going to be a party line vote and the Republicans are in the majority. The thing about Hayden, though, is that there are two things. One is silly, but I find disturbing. The other is just disturbing. The disturbing part is he has presided over this fishing expedition into the phone calls and emails of what's pretty much the entire United States of America. They say they have a database of 200 million individuals. How many people are there in this country? And a lot of them are children.
I mean, 259 million?
This is practically every adult human being and some kids in this country. This is as close to being a sweep of the entire nation, as might be possible, since babies tend not to carry cell phones.
And yet he cannot confirm or deny.
Yes, he cannot confirm or deny. And the thing that bothers me about that is that one of the excuses that the intelligence community gave for not being able to suss out 9/11 before it happened was they had too much on their plate. They had too much information. It took them too long to get to it. That the message that said we're ready to go wasn't even decoded until the day after September 11th. And now they're adding 200 million more records to that database.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing, and this is the silly thing, but it bugs the crap out of me, is that Hayden was recently on Sean Hannity's program. You know, Sean Hannity is a fountain of misinformation and a basic right-wing puppet. And Hannity asked him about the Fourth Amendment, asked Hayden about the Fourth Amendment, and said, well, you know, Hannity said the Fourth Amendment says there has to be that we're protected against unreasonable searches and seizures, and that there has to be probable cause for a warrant to be executed. And Michael Hayden, who has run NSA for years, said, listen, I know the Fourth Amendment, and all it has is a reasonableness clause. Doesn't say anything about probable cause. It's just whether it's a reasonable idea to search. Well, that's completely wrong. 100% completely wrong. I can't believe that Sean Hannity was right and Michael Hayden was wrong on that. What does that mean about the guy?
Well, there was another report that he said he really doesn't have a working knowledge of the Fourth Amendment because he's not an attorney, he's not a constitutional scholar. So that's another take from
Hayden. That's appalling.
Hayden. Yeah, well, yeah, that's who we got. The whole story, the whole context for the Michael Hayden story to head the CIA starts with, I think it goes far, far back in time. We know that he's replacing Porter Goss, who used to be in the Congress and mm-hmm. then headed the CIA for almost 2 years. And we know that Porter Goss left suddenly on a Friday afternoon when he got wind of this. Now, we also know that there's been a kind of a Team A, Team B from the old Iran-Contras days between the CIA and the NSA. The CIA was not forthcoming with any information about weapons of mass destruction, which has upset the administration. And Joe Wilson, whose wife was in the CIA and was outed, has been aligned with that faction against the administration. So I began to wonder in my own mind if we're seeing a turf battle between the CIA and the NSA, and if this isn't an attempt to get control of the CIA, to get control of its budget, etc., and to make its information work for the Pentagon, because Michael Hayden comes out of the Pentagon. He's a retired Navy admiral. He works for Rumsfeld right now.
Isn't he still on active duty? I thought he was still on active duty.
I believe he's retired right now. And he would essentially be taking budget money from the CIA and funneling it into the Department of Defense, which currently has, the Pentagon currently has, I think, 80% of the $40 billion that we're told is spent on intelligence. And Michael Hayden is also into signal intelligence, mm-hmm. which is surveillance, not human analysis. So I'm wondering if this isn't a huge turf battle in an attempt to rein in the CIA because it's not working on behalf of the administration. I wonder what your thoughts are.
Yeah, well, the NSA strictly, you're right, is strictly electronic surveillance of one kind or another. Everything from spy satellites to listening in on phone calls to intercepting emails and radio transmissions. And one of the failures of 9/11, one of the major failures of 9/11 was no human, as they call it, human intelligence, which means butts on the ground talking to people and worming their way into people's confidence. So, and this is an old conflict. This has been going on for at least 40 years within the intelligence mm-hmm. community, the value of SIGINT, signals intelligence versus HUMINT. I don't know what they're expecting of Michael Hayden except to go along to get along. Negroponte's really running the show now. He is the eminence grise of all this, sitting in the background. And I think they just expect him to do whatever Negroponte says. It's Negroponte they really ought to be questioning, not Michael Hayden.
Well, they did, and they got nothing.
They got Bupkis. And, in fact, they got Bupkis from Hayden yesterday.
Yeah,
he was very nice. He's a lovely man. The Democrats were pretty much hogtied because they like him personally, and they know that he's always been forthcoming with them. But he did not give them anything in public. What happened in closed session? Of course, it was in closed session.
Representative Maurice Henschy, Democrat of New York, asked for an investigation, basically, of NSA. He wanted the DOJ, the Department of Justice, to investigate. He's concerned that we're in the middle of a constitutional crisis that has been set up basically to market White House secrecy. And he was told that the Department of Justice cannot investigate the NSA.
Isn't that appalling?
I mean, that gets to another question. President Bush has signed apparently 750 signings, which is, if you keep a historical perspective, only 340 were signed by all other presidents in mm-hmm. history. Do you want to tell our listeners what a signing is so they understand the significance of this?
Yeah, when the president takes his oath of office, he vows to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, to faithfully execute the laws. When a president issues a signing, what he's saying is, I understand the law, but I choose to interpret it this way. It doesn't mean that I'm violating law. It means that my interpretation of the law may not be what you think it is, but as the executive of this government, and in Bush's case, it's a war president, an executive during war, I am choosing to interpret the law this way. And in the case of the signings that Bush has done, you know, like he really understands the law. But in the case of, you know, they put, here, sign this, Georgie. Okay. Can I get on my bike now? In the case of the stuff that Georgie has signed, it negates the law. It's not an interpretation of the law. It's a negation of the law in many, many cases. And one of the obvious examples is torture. It's against the law to torture. And the Constitution says no cruel or unusual punishment. And you know, one of the signings said, well, we don't really choose to interpret it that way. We choose to interpret it this way, that, you know, you can waterboard people, and that's cool. So that's what the signings are. This is one of the secret things about mm-hmm. government that nobody knew about until a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Clinton issued signings also. Every president issues signings at some point or another. But they're actively seeking in this administration to negate the laws of the land through these signings.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that happened in this interesting White House that we have right now was the Monday night immigration speech. And there were several thoughts in my mind about it. One was distraction. The Senate had just voted in a $70 billion extension of the tax cuts for the next 2 years at a time when we really can't afford it, let's face it, and when we're at war, which is unprecedented. But the other thing I thought about was, here we have we have an agenda now to build a great wall, basically, between the United States and Mexico, 6,000 additional guard troops that we need for all the natural disasters that are coming, disasters that are so prevalent now that the Wall Street Journal a week or so ago actually ran a story about the importance of individuals getting private insurance because FEMA can no longer support them because it went bankrupt with Katrina. So we have these warnings about disasters. We just saw what happened in New England. And now we're being told that, you know, you can forget your National Guard helping you at the local level because we're going to pull them off to do this wall. And the other thing I thought about the wall was, gee whiz, it will keep people from the south of the United States out of our country. But, gosh, Eddie, could it also be used to keep people in the United States?
It could. And, of course, the other shoe is Canada. I mean, you want to talk about a porous border. There are at least people watching the border between the United States and Mexico. You can go it's not Hamilton, Ontario. It's to Detroit by boat. You can take a water mm-hmm. taxi between the two mm-hmm. cities because they're both on the same big lake. And there are vast stretches in the northern United States, North Dakota and Idaho and Montana, where there's nothing. There's not a border guard. You can stand on in both countries at the same time just by spreading your legs a little bit. Are we going to start putting a fence across Canada also? One of the greatest things about having Canada and Mexico as neighbors for all these years has been the fact that it's an unguarded border. We really didn't have to worry about it. The president's speech was it was applauded by some as being nice and moderate. It didn't appease the right wing of his party, and it certainly didn't appease the Democrats. It was a non-response to a major issue. And it's one of those issues that no matter what side you take, there's going to be something wrong with what you're saying or mm-hmm. something about what you're believing that doesn't sit well. And I know that when my grandparents came into this country at Ellis Island, they stood the risk of being turned away. Fortunately, they weren't, or I wouldn't be here talking to you right now. Mm-hmm. And they went through all the motions. They became citizens. They learned the language, blah, blah, blah. Having said that now, I also know that there are people in Puerto Rico whose native language is Spanish, and the day they're born, they're American citizens. There are people living in Alaska who their native language is Inuit, and the minute they're born, they're American citizens. So what do you do about people like that? Mm-hmm. We have a complicated situation, and again, an overly simplistic and unsatisfying resolution.
Some interesting points of information also came up this week about the immigration plan. People who are applying for citizenship usually take an immigration test. We all know that. Christy Harvey reports that this time people taking the test to be U.S. citizens will get a test that leaves out free press.
Really?
Yep.
Oh, we don't want them to know about it? Is that
right.
The idea?
Right.
That's pretty funny. But
it's also very scary. I mean, it's an indication of what's happening.
It occurs to me, as long as they don't sing the Star Spangled Banner in Spanish, they're in.
Yeah. Maurice Henschy, once again, the Democratic rep from New York, said these are Gestapo-like tactics. He is concerned about the spying program and what's happening with NASA. I started thinking about how all this fits together. I was sort of completing a puzzle in my mind and thinking about the Great Wall and thinking about the combination of the NSA and the CIA and how the Pentagon will get more money out of this deal with General Michael Hayden taking over the CIA. And then the story came out yesterday that the Great Wall is going to be built by Lockheed Martin, Raytheon, and Northwest Grumman, the three biggest defense contractors in the world, probably.
Mm-hmm.
And it occurred to me, where's the money coming from? And then I started thinking about this cohesion between CIA's budget and the Pentagon budget and how much Rummy likes to have control of the money. And I just began to wonder if the immigration plan, the Great Wall, the anti-immigration plan, the Great Wall, wasn't in the works for quite some time, and if it wasn't one of the spinoffs of, oh, look what we'll gain if we take over the CIA.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, George Bush used to be governor of Texas. If anybody knows about border issues, the Texas governor should know about border issues. He never, ever said anything about building a fence when he was looking for the Hispanic vote in Texas. When he became president, when they plucked him from Texas and dressed him up like Charlie McCarthy and made him the president of the United States, he just assumed all the positions that they told him to assume, including supine. And that's what it is. You know, if that's what was in these guys' minds forever, that's what was in these guys' minds forever.
Mm-hmm.
However, having said that, there's also the idea of cheap labor. You know, the thing is that the Republican right, the conservatives, the business community, whatever you want to call them, and I'm not talking about the guys that own your local store. I'm talking about the big evil people behind them. They want slave labor. They can't have slave labor because it doesn't look good. But if you have an illegal worker in this country that's working for $3 an hour or $5 an hour, anything below minimum wage, they're saving money. Plus, it tends to drive down the market for legal labor in this country. So it occurs to me that this is a more complicated situation than I can figure out. Why build a wall if you want the cheap labor?
It occurs to me that we have a win-win here. We get the Defense Department gets to shell out some money to the defense contractors who are very happy with the Great Wall. And the workers who are here, who are commonly called the brown people, will, because of their religious beliefs and because of the guns, God, and gays issues of the conservative evangelicals, will continue to have lots of children. And there is an overriding larger question across the globe: who will do the work in the future? Because our population growth is getting stagnant among white populations, and the brown people will have the babies. So there's perhaps some logic there from their perspective that the 12 million or so that are illegal now will continue to procreate, and they will generate the future workforce.
Well, that may be true. You know, Alberto Gonzalez said the other day that his grandparents might have been illegal aliens. So in three generations, we go from illegal aliens who probably did not speak English to somebody who works in the White House, the Attorney General of the United States.
Who writes torture memos.
So, anything is possible in this great country.
It's kind of like Condi Rice. I mean, a woman from Alabama who grew up black in the South during the Civil Rights era, who doesn't seem to have any memory, really, of what that experience might have been like.
That's the Clarence Thomas thing.
Yeah.
I never had any help. I got here on my own.
Yeah. Another question came to my mind about this NSA data mining. You know, we have this federal law called HIPAA, and it has to do with privacy, and no one is allowed to discuss anything that happens, for example, to a patient in the hospital. It's interesting to me that we are being held to that standard, but the federal government right now is spying on everybody, and that includes their health records.
Yes.
So what might that mean to people? We can be sued, but what about them?
As far as I know, the government can be sued, but I think when you start putting national security into the
Maurice Tenchi found out you can't, the Department of Justice won't go after them.
Right.
So they get a free ride, but we can still be sued.
If the Department of Justice investigators couldn't get enough clearance to look at what was going on in the intelligence community, then we have no hope, certainly. You can put in any FOIA request you want, and it's going to be denied, because all they have to do is invoke national security. And this is what happened during the Nixon administration when he tried to set the CIA on, when Nixon tried to set the CIA on American citizens, and then tried to cover it up by saying it's national security. We don't know how far they can go with this. It doesn't look good.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't look good at all. The polls were interesting in the last couple weeks. Laura Bush is at 60, so they put her out on Mother's Day to basically promote the White House agenda, because she's more popular than her husband, who is now at about 29%. The U.S. Congress is about 23% approval. Idaho, Wyoming, and Utah are the only states where Bush continues to lead. And Tom Oliphant was discussing this with Al Franken a week or so ago, and he said that when you get down into the 40s in terms of poll points, you are losing the center.
Mm-hmm.
When you get into the 30s, you are losing your base. Bush has now dropped below the 30s, so they know they're in big trouble. One of the things that has been coming up on talk radio on KPOJ from callers, which is kind of interesting, people are wondering if we'll have an October surprise this year, just before the midterms. If there's a threat to the victory of the people in power right now, they've got this wall coming up. They've got Hayden doing major surveillance, and some people have actually gone so far as to question, would martial law be imposed? And I think Tom Hartman raised the question.
We've been worried about this for a long, long time. I remember, with the Nixon administration. You want to talk about the template for all of this, which is...
Colby did spying in 1975, director of CIA.
That's right.
On us.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, just on us.
Oh, okay. The Everything they tried to do during the Nixon administration and screwed up because they either didn't do it or they did it sloppily or because the Democrats were in power in the Congress and had subpoena power, all that's gone by the boards now because the Democrats have no subpoena power and they're not in control in Congress, which means that they can hide anything they want to do pretty much because nobody's going to call for an investigation. Bill Frist? I don't think so. Mm-hmm. Dennis Hastert? I don't think so. They're not going to be calling for any investigations. And anytime a Democrat asks for one, he's just voted down or ignored. So I think they're learning from all this. Martial law, one of the things that we talked about during the massive anti-war demonstrations in the 60s was that the government was building camps around the country. And it turned out that that was true. You know, I thought it was lefty paranoia at the time. It turned out that there are these camps, and most of them are sitting idle right now. What are they used for? Well, you know, the talk was that they were going to be herding up peace demonstrators and putting them in these concentration camps. I think they're capable of anything. Frankly, I do. I think that when you have guys like Dick Cheney running the world, they are capable of anything. Mm-hmm. He is an evil man.
Mm-hmm. Wow, you said that with emphasis.
I did. He's loathsome. He's everything. I mean, when you talk about Gestapo tactics, he probably swells with pride and tears, you know, come to his eyes because he probably admires the Gestapo. They got stuff done, didn't they?
The latest issue of Vanity Fair, which has a picture of Anderson Cooper on the cover, who, by the way, is the child of Gloria Vanderbilt. That gives you some clues. They have a feature article this month on Dick Cheney, the Dick Cheney you don't know. So if people are interested in getting another perspective on Dick Cheney, check out the latest Vanity Fair.
His daughter says that he's just a big, cuddly bear.
Is that the gay daughter?
Yes.
Yeah. The one who's angry at...
Mary Cheney, yes.
Been angry at Carrie and Edwards.
But that was, she came out when it was in her father's interest for her to come out. And when John Kerry mentioned it, she went ballistic.
On the question of this land is your land, this land is mine, a couple of points of information came up this week. One, I heard that the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, owns the tower on top of Grand Central in New York City. Did you know that, Eddie?
I had no clue.
Isn't that interesting?
It is, yeah.
And Tom Harkin reported about a week ago, he was covering the evening show for Janine and Sam. And he said there was a report on the Daily Kos, which he wanted to .com, which he wanted to have people verify for him. He asked people if they had been eyewitness to a notion that the Bush motorcade now has Secret Service people with weapons that are basically machine guns with open windows aimed at protesters. Now, it used to be that when the president was in a motorcade, since the Kennedy assassination,
and the thing about Diane Lynn was that she was a good woman gone terribly bad. She'd made a couple of really stupid choices and then was arrogant about it. So sorry, Diane, but you did that to yourself. In general.
And she was a woman.
I'm not sure that matters that much.
You know, I think
here.
The gay community really liked what she did.
I did too, except it was clearly, ill-timed, for want of a better phrase. It could have been done better and it could have been done smarter. And it wasn't done well or smart. I appreciate the emotional thing that went on with it, but it turned out to work against the cause. Now that's not good.
That's not good.
So here in Oregon, I know that I've lived in places with worse candidates than we have here in Oregon. I mean, I know that. I don't know. Is there an answer to this question? I fill out the ballot. The only way I won't fill out a ballot is if I'm dead.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in reflecting on it from a historical perspective, the difference in voting now versus what it used to mean, because I do respect your idea that it's the only time you really feel like a free member of an open society, it used to really mean that to some extent when we were younger. And I think to myself now about young people coming up, driving around in vehicles with cell phones, totally obsessed with, you know, generating a real income and all the things that go with survival, not really getting any civics in their schoolrooms. And I think maybe it is harder for people nowadays to really think about voting and what it means. You and I come from an era when there actually were civics classes in our schools, and that's pretty much gone.
And voting booths.
Right.
I mean, I love vote by mail, but there's something about going into that booth
and
closing
booth.
That curtain
that's
and
right.
flipping those levers. It's magical. There's a moment of transcendence when you do that. There's a front page article on the Oregonian this morning about people giving excuses about why they didn't vote. It's very instructional because all the excuses are insipid. Oh, well, I'm really busy. I mean, you get the goddamn thing in your house for 3 weeks. You know, you think you could take 10 minutes out of 3 weeks and fill out the ballot.
I'm glad that the Oregonian is taking a look at that question. I think it's important. I don't know where it'll go, but just in reflecting also, I remember as a kid, voting was really important to my family. We were, you know, we were long-term, working class Democratic voters. My dad was a union person and all of that. And politics meant something in our neighborhood, in our home, and in our family. And I remember getting to go with my dad. And it was a moment of pride. I mean, these were working class people who came home from work and they went down to the voting booth, and this was in a cold, snowy region, and it was a big deal.
Yes.
And I remember going with my mom and my dad, and I remember being held by the hand, and I remember them telling me how important this was, and then, you know, we'd watch returns. And so there was a whole different context. And of course, I did the same thing with my own family, but, you know, there is something about that time that we have in us that may not be in other people. And even though we know what a sham politics can be, especially with black boxes and all the rest of it, we still have that ethos in us of this means something.
Oh, yeah. The hair never failed to stand up on the back of my neck when I went in that voting booth.
Yep.
It was, like I said, it was a magical, transcendent experience. And the idea that this was an important thing, you know, they used to let school out on election
right.
day. They
right.
used to close the bars on election day in case, God forbid, you got too loaded to make an intelligent vote. At least that's the way it was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
When my mother would come home from work, and she had a three-hour commute every day, an hour and a half each way, and worked hard. And when she came home at night, she made sure she got her little butt out to the voting booth and voted. And we would talk about it later. And,
mm-hmm.
yes, we would stay up and watch
right.
till 2 in the morning to watch right. the election returns.
Right, right.
And we'd all be groggy the next day, but we felt as though we had actually participated in
right.
democracy.
Right.
And now, of course, if you live in Ohio, it's all up in the air. But.
Yeah. Although people are on the black box, I mean, that is a concern about the 2006 midterms, is that people are so on top of the black box question and current failures in the Ohio system that are starting to become real obvious, that it may be a whole different event, and that raises real concerns about whether or not there would be pressure to constrain the population if this administration loses its power.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of electoral politics, the latest issue of The New Yorker has a story about Time magazine having a gala dinner for 100 of the world's most influential people. Now, you and I have talked about, we haven't heard much from Ralph Nader lately. Well, mm-hmm. it turns out he was there. And not only was he there, but he met Steve Wynn, you know, from Las Vegas, the Bellagio, et cetera, the big hotels. And Steve Wynn's wife, Elaine, was excited to meet Condoleezza Rice.
Ralph? Boy, there's a
Freudian
slip.
Yeah, and he's Ralph Rice. Yeah, Condoleezza Rice. And Ralph Nader was sitting next to Steve Wynn and said, I just talked to Condi Rice about the plight of the Palestinians and the collapse of their health care system. She's working on getting emergency medicine as soon as possible. But Nader did ask Steve Wynn for his information card. And Steve Wynn said, I'm an easy guy, I'm easy to find, and I don't have a card. So that was the end of that for Ralph. And then also at the table, he was able to sit next to Laura Bush, or got a chance to talk to her, and also asked her for her contact information. But I don't think that he got too far with that. And I just thought, well, that's the first mention I've heard of Ralph Nader since the last election.
Yeah, he has been conspicuous by his absence, I guess,
yeah.
is the phrase. So
yeah.
I don't know what's going on in Ralphie's life, but I suppose he's gone inward. Maybe he's doing some soul searching, mm-hmm. which I think in Ralph's case is a good idea.
Now, another big story that has been coexisting in the news and not getting a lot of attention is inflation. On the 18th of May, the New York Times had a story about the tax cuts, the $70 billion that was passed. We know now also... China has let its currency rate rise to greater than 8 of Chinese yuans to the dollar, and the dollar is dropping more significantly. I wonder, in your own mind, what is the significance?
Of inflation?
Of inflation and the fact that China, which was just here recently visiting, the leader of China was just here, and one of the things the United States wanted was for currency for them to hook up to the international currency rates, and China refused, and now they've also gone a step further and let the dollar drop even more. And we're already on the brink of inflation, and that's in the news a lot on the business page, and China's just playing its own game.
Well, it is. And remember,
and they own a whole bunch of us.
They own a whole bunch of us.
It's their land, too.
This land is your land. Shay-shay. Okay, well, again, this is complicated, but here's the deal. Conservatives dislike inflation. Why do conservatives dislike inflation? Because generally they are the people who lend money and own property and collect interest on it. If you're collecting 6% interest on something, just to pick a number out of the air, and the money that you are collecting is inflated money, that means it's worth less. So that 6% effectively becomes 4% or 3%, which means that you're pissed off because you're not getting a return on your investment that's commensurate with what you think you should be getting. On the other hand, debtors like inflation because it lessens the amount of value that they actually have to pay on their debts. The real hardcore conservatives want to go back to the gold standard. The real progressives and populists wanted the silver standard or no standard at all. The whole William Jennings Bryan Cross of Gold speech, for those of you who want to go back to some history, just Google Cross of Gold and William Jennings Bryan, and you'll see what I mean. The Chinese own a lot of us. They have property in this country, and here's something I remember.
It's the trade deficit.
Forget the trade deficit. Here's something even more important. Do you know what discounting paper is? This is one of the ways that if you take out a loan at a bank, the bank isn't necessarily holding that loan. The bank may be processing the loan for somebody else, and what they do is they discount the paper. They take your loan and what your loan will repay, and they sell it at a discount to a third party, and that third party is the one that actually makes the profit minus what they paid the bank on your loan. That's called discounting paper. Well, it turns out that the Chinese have been buying a lot of American loan paper, and I'm not quite sure at this point whether it's mortgages or revolving charges like on a credit card or what it is, but China is buying paper, and that means that they're going to be annoyed by inflation. Wall Street was so annoyed by inflation that the single largest drop in, 11 years, 12 years on the stock market happened just a couple of days ago based on the inflation report. And then it dropped the second day, which was yesterday, I believe. It's like over 300 points that the stock market has dropped in 2 days. And again, it's based on inflation fears. Inflation is not good. There's, that country in Africa now that's got 1,000% inflation a year? And it's cost several million dollars in a local currency to buy a loaf of bread.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Weimar Germany, the thing
exactly
that brought the Nazis to power.
I was thinking of the same exact thing, the wheelbarrows full of money for bread,
wheelbarrows full of money, yes.
Well, Eddie, a lot of thoughts were on my mind as I was preparing for this show, obviously, collecting a lot of data so that you and I can have this interesting chat on politics and culture, religion, et cetera, and how they all intersect. And some of the bullet points that I sort of came up with that really raised my concern were the following. Surveillance of U.S. citizens via telecommunications giants. A great wall being built between the U.S. and Mexico that can be used either way to keep people out or keep people in. And draining off our National Guard so that in case of any natural disaster, whether natural or perhaps even generated by HAARP, we've talked about that in the past, we wouldn't have the resources we need to protect ourselves, and there's already stories about how we need our own private flood insurance. There's also the ongoing possibility of contagion. And it turns out contagious diseases, I looked this up, kill greater than 60% of the world's population every year. Are responsible for 60% of worldwide deaths every year. So contagion is a huge way to depopulate. And speaking of that, the bird flu that we're so concerned about, well, the birds from Africa that live in Africa, go to Europe in the summer and come back to Africa, were considered a real concern for everybody. And it turns out this year that the birds had zero H5N1.
That's
zero.
Good. That's very good.
That's very good. Well, that tells us a lot, doesn't it? Because there's still all this concern about bird flu, and so that gets you into more clandestine, scary thoughts. But continuing on, we have the continuing possibility of contagion, whether real or generated. We have the continuation of Rumsfeld, Hayden, Cheney, and their pals. We have the abysmal polls for the Republicans. We have rising inflation, rising fuel costs for American citizens, U.S. citizens. And given all of these things being done in secret, and given China's hardball on currency and the possibility of converting to euros for fuel, and given all the questions callers to talk radio are giving, do they have a point when they fear some kind of dramatic action by this administration?
Dramatic and what
an October surprise.
Oh no, I absolutely think that they've been planning this for a long time. They may not even have an idea of what it's going to be yet,
right,
because they're at the point where even they can't control everything. This thing has blossomed to the point of that's a bad word, probably, because it has pleasant connotations. It's ballooned, it's metastasized to the point now where they're beginning to lose control of their own game. And whatever they do may not be enough. Now, on the opposite side of that, if the people who listen to talk radio, who have their opinions formed by talk radio, they're convinced that the Democrats have no alternatives. And the Democrats have not been really good in marketing their alternatives.
Well, they do have alternatives.
Of course they do.
They've come up with lots of ideas. They just have no power.
Of course they do. But they have been very poor in marketing those ideas. Howard Dean, whatever you think about Howard Dean, he's been very, very ineffective as the head of the party, and I really think they need to get somebody else, or at least somebody more vocal.
I think he's very good. I think he's the problem is that he is so far beyond, in terms of being progressive, the standard Democratic Party line. He's always in fights with Nancy Pelosi and those folks. I think he's really good for the party, but they really muzzle him.
Well, you know, the head of
I just sent money to the party because of him.
So did I. Not because of him.
He's
a former governor. He's a former presidential candidate. He's a guy well known as a guy who's ready to speak his mind, sometimes to the point of hurting himself by doing it. He can call a press conference anytime he likes, and he can get a microphone anytime he likes. And hasn't done it.
Well, you know, I don't know the backstory politics, but I do think they've got a kind of a leash on him. But, you know, we're almost at the end of this hour, Eddie, and we'll have to unravel that piece later. There is a big film opening today, Eddie.
Oh, the Da Vinci Code? Yes, I've seen this movie.
Have you?
I have.
It seems like the real story is the marketing. The real story about the Catholic Church hasn't really come into play, although the latest New Yorker has a story about it, and it turns out it's opening the door for new recruits to Opus Dei.
Well, here's the thing. Unlike the book, which is very unrepentant about its look at Opus Dei, the film goes out of its way in a very pivotal scene. If anybody notices, it might go right past you, that they say, this is not Opus Dei. This is a clique within Opus Dei and within the Catholic Church that's evil. It's not the Church or Opus Dei that's evil. The movie's way too long. It's very talky, just like the book was very talky. I have no idea why they chose Tom Hanks for the role, because he's not really right for it.
Box office run, Howard, Tom Hanks, and 40 countries, 60 million book sales. I mean, it's a money deal.
You know, on the surface, it might have seemed a good idea, but he's wasted in the movie. Jean Reno, the great French actor, is wasted in the movie. Audrey Tautou is adorable, but, you know, and she's pretty good in an action film, I have to admit.
Who would have been better instead of Tom Hanks?
Oh, God, even Clooney, George Clooney would have been much better.
Clooney would have been better.
Much better, yeah. Tom tries to play an adorable. He's not adorable in this movie. He shouldn't be, anyway. The movie, I enjoyed the film, but not as much as I should have. And if I were allowed to edit the film, it would be under 2 hours instead of 2 hours and 33 minutes long.
There's also the new Al Gore film on the environment coming out next
Haven't
month.
Seen that yet.
So that's, we want to really remind people to pay attention to that.
Yeah, and you can go online to crooksandliars.com, and you can see that Saturday Night Live opening, which he did last week, which was very, very funny. I don't watch the show anymore, but I've seen that thing online, and where he does a speech in the second year of his second term, talking about the state of the world. It's a very, very funny little bit.
Excellent. Well, Eddie, it's 10 o'clock. People are listening to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band. There are a bunch of young students out at the front door. I can see them on the monitor getting ready to come in for their tour of community radio. That's great.
We have a lot of young people at the station now. It's wonderful.
Right. It's good to know that we'll be replaced any day here. Is there anything you wanted to say about politics or film that we didn't already talk about?
Gee whiz, no, except pay attention, vote. Because the thing that they want best is for you to turn off and not vote.
Mm-hmm. Well, Eddie, this is the end of our season, and I want to thank you for your ongoing intellectual curiosity, your time, your courage to engage in these kinds of conversations in these kind of strangely historic times. It's really meant a great deal to me and I think to the listeners. So thank you so much for another great season.
Hey, listen, talking to you is always fun. We talk like this on the phone. We might as well do it on the air.
You mean the phone? The phone?
I'm never talking on the phone again. We're going to have to learn Esperanto or something to talk on the phone.
Well, Eddie, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Have a good summer.
You bet. So I'm going to go out now with another Kingston Trio tune, and you may remember this one, and maybe it's a nice summary for what we've been talking about. It Takes a Worried Man.
Uh-huh.
Okay, see ya, Eddie. And that's not queuing up here. Let's see if I can make that happen. We're losing that piece. Don't you just love it? The Kingston Trio, Takes a Worried Man. We're all worried people. We're also complex people, and worry's not the only thing we do. We talk to each other. We have joy in our lives. And one of the people who helps us remember all of those other parts of ourselves besides the worried part is Martine Prichtel, who is here with us in the studio. Just to let you know, if you haven't already heard Martine on the show, he's a regular feature every year in May. It's kind of a special, magical time for us. Martine kind of helps us close out the season. He is an author, an artist, a singer, a healer, and a teacher. He's returned to Portland to present a talk entitled, you'll love this, Sending Our Fascists Out for Donuts of Consciousness. This presentation will take place tonight at 7 o'clock at Looking Glass Books at 318 Southwest Taylor. That's in the downtown Portland area. Looking Glass Bookstore, 7 p.m. tonight. Donation $3 to $15 on a sliding scale. According to Martine Prechtel, the lecture will explore learning to turn our grief and rage into the heat and humus of living ground, where together by planting and replanting, we can keep the seeds of vision, beauty, generosity, and the possibility of real cultures warm, alive, and regenerated in this ice age of television, numbness, war, and mediocrity to feed a time beyond our own. What a concept. Martine will also lead a hands-on workshop in Portland on Saturday and Sunday, this Saturday and Sunday. And for information, you can contact Richard Seidman at 541-488-1192. That's 541-488-1192. And hopefully the front desk will have that for you. Or you can reach them online at Flowering Mountain, one word, flowering, as in flowers, floweringmountain.com. Martine Prechtel's life, the subject of his books, Secrets of the Talking Jaguar, Long Life, Honey in the Heart, The Toe Bone and the Tooth, took him from his native New Mexico upbringing as a half-blood Native American from a Pueblo Indian reservation to the village of Santiago Atitlan in Guatemala, where he eventually served the Chuchitzil Mayan population as a full village member and became a principal in the body of village leaders responsible for instructing the young people in the meanings of their ancient stories that took place in the rituals of adult rites of passage. Martine once again resides in his native New Mexico, teaching internationally through story, music, ritual, and writing. He helps people in many lands to retain their diversity while remembering their own sense of place in the daily sacred through the search for the indigenous soul. It's a pleasure and an honor once again to welcome him back. Martine, hello.
Hello, Marlene. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Oh, I'm very good now that I'm here seeing you. I think we're better now. Since driving up from California trying to get here on time to see you.
Well, you made it, and it's a real treat to have you. I'm really charmed and fascinated by this title for your speech tonight at Looking Glass Books, Sending Our Fascists Out for Donuts of Consciousness. Tell us about that.
if I tell you about it, then I have nothing to say tonight.
Well, give me a byline. Where do you get these donuts for people who can't make it?
It comes from wanting your having your cake and eat it too. Uh-huh. I said, well, let's just make different kind of cake.
Mm-hmm.
That way, if they get it and have it too, maybe they'll stop wanting to have it and get it too. I don't know. The thing is, I always thought of the human soul as being something more natural than what everybody was telling us when we were little kids. You know, I grew up on the res, and with Native folk, I mean, the idea of a human soul or a consciousness was something like more like a grizzly bear or a water bug or a weather formation. And everybody sort of had a responsibility to take care of those things individually and collectively, so that the entire village was kind of like an enormous earth anatomy of all these incredible forces, of which we as humans, the main thing that we had in our capacity was to feed them spiritually. So whenever this whole idea of having a mind that conformed to a society that told us that actually our souls and our consciousness were all about the same size and about the same shape, which meant really square and flat. You know, by the time I was about 13, I thought, oh, that's just not possible for me to be that, you know. And so at some point or other when I was teaching, trying to get the point across in my own insane way, I said, well, it's like there's a part of our being who has become what you might call an acquired personality in order to survive, in order to keep alive the beautiful part of us and the indigenous part of us, which is basically living underneath an enormous sea of grief for not being able to be natural in such a world as we live at the moment, at least in the modern world. And so I was saying there's a part of us that ends up endorsing, even mostly unconsciously by the use of language, a kind of almost internal fascism that does not give a vote to the rest of our body and the rest of our being. or the rest of us collectively with those beings. So you end up, I always thought of it as a fascist, as not so much somebody who had their own ideas, but somebody that didn't have any of their own ideas, was always doing what somebody else thought that you should in order to keep everything a certain way. Very, very violent, very, very incapable with grief, very incapable with beauty. So whenever those guys are running the show, it seems like you would have a hard time doing any of your knitting there in the front room if you had a fascist staring at you all the time. So I thought, wow, best thing to do is send them out for donuts. And while they're out doing donuts, we'll get to work doing stuff in here by the time they come back. And everybody used to say to me, oh, wouldn't the best thing be to change the locks? And I said, no, I think the terrible thing about changing the locks is then you're locked in too. And the point is not to lose consciousness or get rid of this part of yourself or this part of our nation or this part of our world, but make it so we can metabolize that down into a grief that could actually make life beyond the insistences of the stupidities of a past of flight away from our origination points. But how to accomplish that in one afternoon? Well, of course, that would be something the fascists want to do, because they want to get it done in one afternoon because it's, quote, effective. And I know we're in the city that works, but we have to go slow with work.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have firsthand experience with fascists. For people
who
don't know your story, you were in Guatemala before. You were in Guatemala before the Reagan-Bush administration, and then you were directly involved in the illegal Contra War, and you saw a lot of that kind of behavior, fascist behavior. Ooh. Anything you want to share?
Well, of course, a lot of it's in the books, but sure. I mean, the thing is, that's not over either. I mean, everyone's saying, well, that was then. Oh, no, this is now.
It's all now.
It's even more now in some ways, although the obvious killing. I mean, everyone always thinks of fascism, it's oppression of violence. Well, in Guatemala, which some people may not even be aware of where it actually is, they always think, oh, it's south of Mexico. It's actually east of Mexico, south of Yucatan. And should belong to Chiapas culturally because they're all Mayan people. And it's a country that is probably, you would say, 95% genetically Mayan Indian and probably 70% totally Native American from the point of view that everyone's still speaking their language and trying to live an Indian life. But during those terrible years, which were, of course, this was in the late 70s and throughout the 80s and part of the 90s, they're really the product of the 1930s and the 1920s when they had all the so-called communist purges, everywhere in the world, the same story. And then those, of course, were a product of stuff from the 1860s and ad infinitum. So the thing about in the 80s is that the Americans supported quote-unquote fascists were not using their own ideas. What they were doing is basically keeping the line for certain entities in this country and in other, you might say, commercial interests throughout the world, some German, Japanese, etc., such as a big cabal, which is still there and still operating quite effectively. And as a result, the engineered killings, which were always proposed in other American newspapers as a civil war, which I could never understand how a civil war could be between people that were not from the country. Is the people in the country were dying, but only a few of the people from the country were really the people involved. So we got to see all the kind of subversion. I mean, soldiers dressing up like guerrillas, and committing atrocities so that people would join the right. And, left wing saying this and saying that to get them behind the movement, which was actually to get rid of the multiplicity of languages. And then all of the, the jailings and the terrorisms and the poisonings and the confiscations of land because of the forced conscriptions, which are now no longer in order, but getting ready to put them back in, apparently. So, it's an enormous story in very long. And, of course, I wasn't from Guatemala, so technically speaking, most people say, well, you could have just left. But you see, I was so ingrained and so in love and also so married in and so much part of the place where I was living, which was a very large town of Mayan people, Tzotzil people, called Santiago Titlang, that I would never have thought to leave ever in my whole life, even better just to live and die there. But actually, I had a teacher or an old guy who was my man and everything, taught me so much. And he told me I had to go and keep the things alive that we were trying to do there, because he perceived that they would probably disintegrate as a result of all the things coming in from the outside, which are not just the fascism, but the culture necessary for that sort of insanity to exist. So the native cultures, as it were, I mean, I've been accused of trying to pretend like I was the last of the Mohicans or something, but I was not the last of the Mohicans. I was just the last Martin, and the only Martin there was there. And he said, Nicolas Chevalier, he says, take these seeds that we've been planting here and plant them in the place where the bullets are coming from, and do not be prejudiced against the form that they take when they sprout. And I thought, well, Nicolas knows what he's talking about. This guy's 97, he's dying. He's just talking metaphorically about the teachings. But what he was actually saying was that when you plant something, you've got to take care of it and you got to let it grow, but then you can't be mad at it because it doesn't look like the thing you put in the ground when it comes up, with which the human soul is very often the case, because when you take something from another place and you grow it in a new place, it has to adjust to the conditions. And I found that to be actually true genetically, even with the corn I brought back. When I started growing it here, I said, wow, this stuff looks really different. And I started giving it away, and it kept coming back crossed on other people's corn. And then I realized old-time Mayans, whenever they married or whenever they visited, they brought seeds to each other. So this whole idea of saving seeds to keep them pure has an element of fascism as well. So the whole idea was to, in the old Mayan way, was to constantly revitalize your seeds by everybody mixing diversely all of their different ways and all of their different understandings, as long as it was governed by a love for something bigger than just human existence. And so I go around doing these ritual gatherings that have been called workshops. And granted, we do a lot of work, but it's really a ritual gathering, you see. And it's exactly that planting of seeds so that they do not so much so that the knowledge stays pure, but so that it constantly gestates into something that has the spiritual DNA integrity of something that's much bigger than me, much bigger than our time, and hopefully for a time beyond our own.
You said something interesting, Martin, and I want to remind our listeners, you are Martin Prechtel. You will be doing a talk tonight at Laughing... I'm sorry... Looking Glass Books.
We should call it Laughing Glass.
Yeah, The Looking Glass Bookstore, wonderful little bookshop in Portland on 318 Southwest Taylor. Those folks are great. They've always hosted you.
Yes.
There is a donation of $3 to $15. And you will be talking about that, and then you'll have a workshop this weekend, and people can hook up with that by going to floweringmountainoneword.com or calling 541-488-1192. You talked about the culture that has to be readied for fascism. What does that mean for you, or what was that about?
I thought,
We're sort of in that space right now.
America is a strange, so-called America. Everything in the English language that has come down to be an American English actually comes from a time of human displacement, which took place continually in Europe for thousands of years. I mean, English didn't even arrive as a recognizable language till the 1100s. And then it was already Christianized, it was already monotheistic, and it was already a proselytizing language, and it was also illegal not to speak it in England where nobody spoke it. And it ends up being the same kind of syndrome here in what is now known as North America, because the truth of the matter is everybody that ended up, not everybody, but huge quantities of the people that ended up in North America, normally known as white people, which I don't like the word because none of them are white, and it's just a catch-all term that means nothing. They're basically descended from people who had all that sort of insane fascist mentality of the past forced down their throat, and then became unconsciously, or even consciously to some degree, the purveyors of the tears of their own losses onto other people. So in other words, once you've lost who you are after, five or six generations, then the only way to get an identity is to remove them from the native folks here or the ground itself, the indigenous plants, indigenous animals. And then finally, you're saying, okay, I'm sitting here depressed. Why am I depressed? One, I don't have a true origins, and the only way I can feel important is by exporting what I think is a real life, which is this absorbed and obtained life onto everybody else around me. There's nobody left to put it on. Now what do I do? So what I'm saying is that fascism is the worst case scenario of that. In other words, I'm not saying that is fascism, but I'm saying it's really ripe when what happens is an incredible part of our own souls, or an incredible large and growing part of the population is ignored by people who finally got their comfort. So, I mean, like, for instance, Guatemala, not to use the states right now, because that's a big subject, but we should go there, is that in Guatemala, for instance, you have all these quote-unquote right-wing people who essentially have no basis in the country. And so it was a colony. And all of their economic base was based somewhere besides Guatemala, so they were basically plundering the land, just like here, and sending it to somewhere else. Sometimes it's the States, sometimes it was Europe, different places. But they really had no, what you might call, identity except for being overlord. Then when you get the children of these people who no longer even do that, they're like, what do I do now? Who am I? And it just becomes this vacant, incredible life. Then when the instigation of television and all of this other kind of misused communication devices, then you get a fascism that not only has an efficiency that's so fast, but then the people start thinking that's how you're supposed to be. In other words, if you don't have a hard face, if you're not able to be sacrificial to everything you meet, in other words, cut everything down to the ground instead of trying to find its beauty and keep it alive, then it becomes a way of life. And then they start fighting amongst each other. So the main thing is that among the fascist types of mentality, which are always generally, strangely enough, fundamentalist movements, whether they're fundamentalistically religious or religiously fundamental, or if they're ideologically fundamental, whether they're like Mussolini or Hitler or like Milosevic or any of the other guys out there, or they're a little more subtle than that. What it generally is that people that cannot go any farther forward with the places they've thrown away, so they try to go back to where it was comfortable for their particular quote-unquote class, which originally was a class that was not sitting on top, but a class that decided it was never going to get on the bottom again. And so they end up, making sure that everybody who's there is on the bottom. So this vertical mentality is very, very easy to maintain with violence. I mean, it's very easy. If you have a family, someone's got a bullet pointed at your son's head, said, do this, chances are you're going to do it. And that's in Guatemala. I watched this hundreds of times. There's nobody in our old village, including myself, who doesn't have a bullet hole wound. I got mine right in my chest. Shrapnel wound, machete wound, or the terrible... I mean, actually, physically, everybody has one. Everybody has one. And there's nobody that didn't see somebody killed. And that's what created the problem later, you see. Because the trauma of seeing that makes people so they lose that wonderful dance with life of maintaining the holy. Yeah. I'm very talkative. I just got out of the car.
Oh, no, I'm very glad you are. And I'm really, I'm kind of sad that we have to open up some of these things that are wounds for you. But
it's fine.
People need to understand what the realities are of this time in which we're living.
The thing is that people don't understand that in order to use a carpet, somebody's got to die in Cameroon, okay? And in order to have your lawnmower, somebody in South Africa is barely feeding their family. And all the hippies and the hip people, they talk about stuff like that and they know about stuff like that. But the truth of the matter is you cannot feel righteous because you know about it. It doesn't make it happen, change. The difference is to be able to have a beauty and a sense of humor in an everyday life so the life you are leading is not this stone-faced hatred of what you cannot change, but be able to deal with the things that you are in your everyday life and continue to work for those things that must be changed, act in an activist way or, in many, many ways. I mean, a lot of people going at it, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's become an industry, basically, which is, all kinds of ascending masters are all of a sudden, more aware of this and more aware of that. I'm nothing. I'm just a little fool on the street corner. I come around once in a while, and I love the people. And that's all I can do. But I never stop hammering on the issue, but I also say, because I've been shot at so much and I've seen so many people killed and I've seen so many of my friends actually be more destroyed by not dying because they get bitter, I said, no, I'm not letting the enemy stop the beauty. I'm not going to let it happen. Because if there's anything we can do, that's the only thing I got in my hand that I have any control over.
You know, you raise an interesting point that has sort of been floating around in my mind lately, and of course it's no surprise when we end up thinking the same kinds of thoughts. There's something about that as well. But I've been thinking about people who are essentially comfortable people, who really don't want to deal with the problems that we're facing. Mm. It's too painful for them, et cetera, et cetera. And part of me began to wonder if this wasn't some kind of guilt. You know, it's almost like that NAMBY idea. I've got mine, and I don't want to deal with that stuff. Right. It's too negative. It makes me uncomfortable. And then there are other people who see what's going on and still are able to maintain their sense of beauty as you are. And I just wondered if you thought about that or see some differences, because there are a whole lot of folks out there that are really shut down on what they call the negativity or what they think of as the dark light, the shadow. And it just seems to me that's not the way we ought to be going.
Well, that's what makes fascism work, is if people shut down, because then the sociopaths are the only ones running the show, because they don't feel one way or the other. The thing is, when it's too negative and too hard for people, that's very true. I mean, you can't just throw pus and poison into a pot and say this is life, because it's not life. And the thing is, with the media as it is, where you can hear, you know, for instance, if you were in a village, an intact village, you wouldn't hear about that much negativity in the day. It wouldn't even be possible to get a hold of that. As soon as you can, you are overwhelmed. This is beyond a doubt. But what I have to say about that is this. Is that people who are living an intact life do not live it alone, and therefore the burden has to be carried collectively to some degree, and that all people really actually descend from all these troubles. And if you talk to somebody, for instance, that was in Auschwitz, which there's not too many left anymore, but if you had the occasion to see any of the people who came out of any of the prison camps and from Idi Amin or any of these guys, you don't see those people as bitter. They don't generally talk about the camps that much. But you don't see them, you know, going around, you know, beating the walls. It's their kids that go crazy. And then the grandkids that try to live in denial, because they actually inherit what the grandparent has. So the Mayans think that grandparents give their lives to their grandchildren, and then it passes. There's always two generations that are opposed to each other in every generation. So I think the thought is that in a place where people can drug themselves out or put themselves into a kind of an insulated situation where they don't have to see what's going on in the rest of the world, thinking that that's their problem because they're just not doing it right, or in the worst case scenario, which I really hate, is the people who say, well, it's their karma, and my karma must be good because I haven't had to experience bullets whizzing past my ears, which is actually what exports the bullets to the other places. So it's very difficult for people to understand that, because it takes an enormous intelligence and an enormous overview, and also having gone around a little bit and look at what's going on right under your nose. So right here in your town, you've got lots of things that if somebody wants to go look at. I mean, a lot of disenfranchised children, people drugged out their minds, people trying to kill themselves, this, that, and the other thing. And yet there's a lot of people that do care about these things. There's not just a couple, there's a lot. But what do you do in a mega situation like what's going on in the world? One individual can make a difference, but one individual can't fix it. And so the idea of wanting to fix it, of course, is part of the problem, because that's that whole idea of human-centered activity. Once I get it fixed, then I'm going to have it comfortable. And then it's not going to be any problems ever again. And then it'll be Star Trek and everybody gets beamed up. And Mayans say, no. Humans are not here to have comfort. Humans are here to know that heaven is a moment. And sometimes they string themselves together like jade beads, and you can wear them around and laugh together. And then sometimes they're not, you know. So the thing is that if you're around the campfire in the morning and everybody has a cup of tea or a cup of coffee and no one has died that day, and we're all laughing and we have some deliciousness in our language, then you understand that a culture that is small to the outside appearance is enormous from the spiritual standpoint, whereas a culture that has to constantly have mega buildings and mega this and bigger that and all these kind of things buzzing around in order to divert them from the reality of their amnesia, of their true humanness, then what happens is the people who are got all the big stuff end up with a top-heavy entropy or atrophy of culture that has to crash in, which becomes either spiritual depression, actual economic depression, or physical depression. All of those things happening as in front of our face. But you can also make an enormous cosmetic on that to pretend like it's not happening for quite a while. And they say, well, the main thing that most people say in a bad English, they say, if it's all going to end, what's the difference? I might as well get mine, stay drugged up in the fortress, and let it all die that way. But that's not the case. That's not the way it works. for two reasons. One, by staying in the fortress, you're perpetuating and exacerbating the situation. Two, it's none of your business. The business of being a human being is making beauty and being small and having that depth. So if you don't have the depth of soul, don't have the capacity with metaphor, don't have any mythological life, then that is definitely the beginning of the end for human beings. So I say it can change, it can be different, that there is an indigenous soul living inside of all people, no matter how far to the left or to the right there, that seem to be drifting. That does not mean that that indigenous soul is going to stick its head out and say, oh, hello there. It's like, I remember you, what you did last time I stuck my head out. I've been in the res for a long time here. So it's probably hiding and waiting for you to court it. How do you go about that? Well, there's a million ways, and I only know a few, and that's why I go around doing what I do, you know. I can't do that on the radio, of course, but I can talk about doing it. And so we have our little groups because it's more hands-on, you know. But,
you know, you talk about
people have a good thing in them. They do somewhere.
Yes,
know.
They do. Yeah. And one of the things that's been interesting is that drugs increasingly are used as a way to marginalize people, mm-hmm. To label them and to dismiss them. But there are other drugs that we don't talk about in the same way, but they're just as deadly. And I think consumption, this quest for new things, because there actually is some recognition now that when people go shopping and buy something, they get a rise in their endorphins. Sure. They get a feel-good hormone release when they're able to buy something. It has something to do with, you know, making yourself self-esteem go up or feeling better about yourself or something. All the constellation of factors that occur in a culture that's very consumption oriented. But yet I think that's probably one of the most dangerous drugs we have.
Well, they're all the same. Yeah. It all comes down to the same. It's just a way to...
So we're all being drugged.
Yeah, the idea is euphoria as opposed to ecstasy. I mean, the ecstatic cultures, I mean, humans, to me, are not rational beings by nature. I mean, that's an insanity. And so their inability to be rational always makes them feel like they're failures. And so the main thing is for them to be euphoric, you know, mm-hmm. to get a new boat, to get a new this, to get a new that, and it's never new for two or three days, and there's no love of the matter. Intact cultures are ecstatic. They love the little wood, and they love the little piece of that bronze that came from grandma, and they love these little things. And they also have a mythological connection to the story of how they got to be. But in a culture that is constantly, or I should say, I don't even want to call this a culture. It's what I call, the modern cultures are cultural avoidance systems, which are, to me, things that are constantly trying to fill a hole of a hunger personified. The whole culture is a great big belly trying to fill itself with more of itself by eating its toe and then complaining about the pain. Instead of saying, okay, well, then we'll eat the world. So they eat the world, which is also their toe. The truth of the matter is, I feel that if the grief of remembrance, and I'm not talking about just remembering who we are or where we're from, I'm talking about something big that's really deep in our bones. If that can come to a place of consciousness in a way that's not too sudden, because if it comes too fast, then everyone's going to take their drugs to numb up, because when that thing knocks on the door, you're going to think you're 8-ball, because you're the only one in the neighborhood doing it, you see. Instead of understanding that's really... really the human force and the spiritual aspect of our indigenousity. But if you're taking your drugs in order to drug, in other words, to numb your grief, to numb your capacity to feel, then the only thing you can do is constantly, in order to feel, to get through that 3-inch armor, which is not just caused by drug, but by the cultural idea of consuming the world, then what happens is it takes so much more to get through, so you have some feeling. But once you have a feeling, then the grief wants to leak out, and so you want to cut that off. So it's this back-and-forth pulse, which is really good for the economic system and really bad for the economy. So I'm saying this is that the capacity for a person to be intact is what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a person or a culture being successful. I'm talking about it being intact so that its existence makes it so something can live beyond itself in a way that has happiness, which is not euphoric, but tends toward ecstasy. And ecstasy is not happy. It is both grief and the deepest emotion for being alive.
Whew. I just like picking your head because you're thinking such a different way. So I'm going to just keep throwing questions, and you just keep
it. You mean everybody don't think just like me? I think they do. Maybe.
Bless your heart. You got a special main line to something. We just had a lot of talk this week about immigration, and you know we're going to build a great wall with our neighbors to the south, which holds them out and can also hold us in.
Absolutely.
I just wondered what your thoughts were on this whole thing that is called immigration.
Well, you know, this is what we're talking about already, really. I mean, the idea is that it's basically an incapacity to understand that none of the people who want this are from here. And so it's another way of defining. When the people lose their tribe, you know, it's like a lot of Native people I grew up with, myself included, when we end up in a city, we lose so many of our customs and our relationships to all our people. And pretty soon we say, only way that I'm going to know if I'm an Indian is by saying I'm not a white guy. And pretty soon being an Indian means not being a white guy. And that doesn't even count as being a Native at all. I mean, then you go back to the res, nobody knows you. They say, wow, there's a white guy, you know. So the people, in order to have an identity, pretty soon have to say, okay, we got to draw a line, who's who and who's not. Anciently, this has been tried millions of times all over the world. Hadrian's Wall, the so-called Great Wall of China, which was made somewhere around 57 different times in different chunks. And almost in every capacity in which it was never made to keep out the barbarians. This is what history books teach you, but you can read the Chinese documents. They're mostly in treaty relationships with all the native people on the other side of the walls so that they do not lose their slaves. In every case, the Chinese said, well, we're going to put this wall up here so that the deserters, as they call them, do not run to become free barbarians. So this whole idea of trying to, you know, build this Nazi prison wall down there in the south, well, first of all, it's going to fail. And second of all it's going to make is a war zone, and which it already is, in case nobody knows that, if you haven't visited in the right places. It is definitely a war zone. So I don't think the immigration or de-immigration or any of this sort of thing has any validity until the people who live in this country have come to to terms with the great heartbreak of their own ancestors who didn't come here high and mighty, most of them. They came here very, very, very displaced, extremely misled, misguided because Europe had not seen a natural land in 2,000 years, and as soon as it saw it like somebody, you know, held in prison and sees a 16-year-old girl and it rapes. And it's a very bad scene. So until you come to terms with the reality that the entire culture is built on a bad foundation, and it has to start from the bottom again, that what they're creating is the same thing you're going to do when you try to attack certain sicknesses with antibiotics or poisons. What you do is you make the thing you're trying to get rid of stronger and stronger and stronger. The Chinese are going to get stronger. Mexicanos are going to get stronger. Guatemalans are going to get stronger. And the part of them that's going to get stronger is the part that everyone's trying to keep out. But Mexico has the most incredible cultures. One of my favorite countries in the whole world. But that's not the only thing people are trying to keep out. And it's also not done in order to keep them out. It's not done in order to control the immigration so that the slave workforce can be kept at a certain wage. And so they don't have to spend, you know, quote-unquote public money, which they're not spending anybody anyway, except for sending bombs to someplace, which is all eight ball. So it's all fascist craziness, man. You know, it's all fascist craziness. But I tell you, it's going to backfire anyway.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Because New Mexico, we have a different governor, you see.
Yeah, you have Bill Richardson.
We got Bill Richardson.
What's
going
different?
For it.
What's different?
Well, he's still a guy with a suit, and he's still a little bit on the other side of things from me. But I know him since I'm a kid, and he's not going to play that game with those guys, you know.
Well, they have ways.
Oh, they do have ways, but there's lots of other things too. New Mexico, nothing works. Nothing. There was the first governor of New Mexico said anything that works anywhere else in the world will not work in New Mexico, and anything that tries to counter that will not work either.
Why?
It's just the nature of the land.
Is it because the people are varied and from
land
south?
Yeah, they are.
And they just don't buy in.
Well, they were kept out of the United States intentionally till 1914, because the American government said, if we let those people in there, they're going to vote Democratic every time because they're all Spanish-speaking. So they made a law you had to be English-speaking, and that's where that came from. And they would not let the New Mexicans in. They finally did get in, and they, of course, voted Democratic. and upset the balance in the Southwest. But it's not the only reason. The other reason is because nobody in New Mexico thinks they're from the United States. They all just say we're invaded, but we're from New Mexico.
So. What about the land that's been so decimated in New Mexico from the nuclear adventure?
In the South, yeah. Well, and in Los Alamos. Well, this is a big issue right now, big issue, because I grew up with all that insanity myself. It's one of the reasons that I talk the way I do. So that's all the same stuff. The land that's been really decimated is actually in Nevada and Utah. New Mexico only had one bomb blow up there. But the thing is, the so-called public land is now owned by the military. They don't let you go on anymore. I had a friend from Kazakhstan once, wanted to go ride the horse with me. He's a nomad. It took him 50 days to get security clearance so he could go ride a horse at my house, because they have this invisible wall around certain areas in New Mexico.
Is that the White Sands area?
Yeah, they got there, but Los Alamos, too, around Santa Fe, too. Yeah, nobody knows, but it's there because I tried.
Santa Fe?
Yeah. That whole area that's got a big parameter there, you can't go in unless you're a certain kind of person.
Is that like Santa Fe is a gated community?
No. It's not gated in that sense, but like if somebody comes from a restricted country and you want to bring them into the area, they have to go through an enormous security clearance.
But they can go into Albuquerque?
That probably is dicey as well.
Huh.
That's dicey as well. Eastern New Mexico will be all right. It's very crazy. I didn't know that. I was in Denver at a conference. This is years ago, okay, when the Soviet Union hadn't broken up yet. And this guy was, you know, Kazakhstan, the Soviets had taken that the same way the Americans had taken the American West, right? Mm-hmm. And that's where their plutonium is. It's all in Kazakhstan. So this guy wanted to come. So right away, you know, they figured that he's a professor, but he's also a nomad. And mm-hmm. So he's a good friend of mine, a wonderful little guy. Beautiful horse riding character in his little family. And they had him on the chain, essentially. And I said, well, look, can you come and ride? And he said, oh, yeah, well, let's go riding because I have horses. And when you come to Kazakhstan, you ride. You know, da, da, da. So I couldn't get him in there. I said, well, why not? I said, well, it's a restricted area, you know, in the Soviet system, and Soviet side. And I said, well, what about Los Alamos? They said, well, you can't come in because it's within a certain distance of that. We're afraid of terrorism. This is way before all that other stuff. And so it's still like that, and even more so like that. And then there's days where it's blocked off. You can't go certain roads. You know, something's up. So they're always trying to take their plutonium down to the south and stick it in the ground. You always see white deers running around the mountain. So there's lots of negative thing if you want to see it, but you can't forget about that. And you also can't forget that northern New Mexico devastated as well by the force of the people who worked as grunt workers up there when they first came in, when it was touted as a place to go work, and they didn't give them any of the armor. Mm-hmm. So we lost an entire generation of people, which is why there's so much gang activity in Espanola and why there's so much heroin addiction. And the highest heroin addiction in the country is in a town 24 miles south of me, which is where everybody there is the very, you know, minimum wage paid workers for Los Alamos people, who are all imports. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're colonized the same as the so-called third world. In the same way, and that's why things in New Mexico don't go like they go everywhere else, because the people are like, okay, here we go again, you know.
So, gee whiz, the Great Wall should keep that heroin far away from those people, Mike.
They're the ones selling it. What do you mean? I mean, they didn't open Afghanistan for nothing, you know.
Gee whiz.
Oh, that's terrible. It's awful, you know. I mean, I don't like drugs, you know. I don't use drugs.
Do you have the methamphetamine thing going, too?
Yeah. And that's very, very powerful, and it's killing people just so fast, especially with Native folk.
Yeah.
It's just awful. But to the great credit of the Navajo Nation, they're setting up rehabs now that incorporate whole clans. They're setting up this pretty good idea. I think it's a pretty good idea. Instead of, like, taking this one guy, putting him in jail, and then saying, you know, prosecuting, then sending him to some American rehab where he's there for 6 weeks and he's back out there making it with Drano. They take the mom, the kids, everybody who is affected, whether or not they're involved in the drugs or not, and they all be together with other people who are like that, with the other people who are not like that, which is very, very sane. Mm-hmm. And I've given them, you know, my prayer. I don't know if it's going to work for them because it's a very recent innovation. But it's so rampant that they've actually spending their gross national income on that. You know?
There's a lot of money in Santa Fe coming in from Hollywood and other illustrious places. It's okay. Sort of the epicenter of New Age enlightenment. Is that having any positive effect?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Santa Fe actually is not the epicenter anymore, but it certainly was for a long time. It used to be a big joke. There were 3,000 healers per client, you know. But I stay out of there as much as possible, do a little shopping now and then. But, yeah, there is some good things. And I think one of the major things that has, for me personally, that's come out of that is some distant reversal of the hatred of the land. In other words, like when you got your Los Alamos types coming in there, there were so many people that were just treating the land as object and just throwing everything anywhere, cutting it up, cutting down trees, mining. In other words, to compete with the, quote, American idea of getting a lot of money, a lot of the Spanish-American farmers, some of the native folk, were just trying to get big cars and look hot. And with a lot of the influx of all this, you know, super hip stuff, there was a certain genre of people who really became, fell in love again with their land and decided that's not what we should do. And so there's quite a big movement to keep the petroglyphs from being cracked to pieces, to keep some of the rivers running, stop the damming. You know, even ranchers who have been living there all their life normally would vote for Bush, all of a sudden they're not. These guys with little cowboy hats and these terrible little boots. You know, as I live with these characters, and I have to be friends with them. So instead of saying, well, we're not going to talk to these guys, no, we'll all be at the same dinner table together and have the same rhetoric. They just don't mention the word environment, but they say the same thing. Let's not poison the water, you know. Let's not tear down these trees. Let's not dig these holes. Let's not put a toxic waste dump, one of which they were going to put 1 mile from my house. And we finally got that stopped, but 168 acres, you know, an acre deep. So, I mean...
So they're not supporting Bush?
Well, some of these guys are, but most of them are not. They're not. And
that's very interesting.
It's very strange. Yeah.
Very interesting.
I think mainly just because they perceive him as a businessman who's going to mine it.
Mm-hmm.
And because of all the methane gas and stuff that they want to drill and all the oil up there, they've been fighting.
Are there healthy communities right now in New Mexico, or are they outside the civilized areas?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. New Mexico, my definition of New Mexico is it's not civilized.
Well, that's
so
helpful.
If it's civilized, then it stopped being New Mexico. I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I say all New Mexico is suffering terribly. It's suffering terribly. But there are good people there and good things going on. But, you know, everybody there is so secretive. It's just insane. I'm probably the most outspoken of anybody there. The native people and the Spanish-American people and the old-time cowboys that live there, they're so secretive, man. They don't even tell their boots what the other boot is doing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's just terrible. But,
they've learned.
They learned the hard way. They learned the hard way.
They keep their mouth shut.
But me, to get back to some of the why I do what I do is I have a little school that meets there, and I bring everybody to New Mexico for two reasons. One, so that they can spend their money in our community and help boost it, because so they don't all have to go work in Los Alamos. But the other reason is because the people come from the outside. The local guys say, well, look, these people love what we love. It means we're not isolated. And then also the people coming from the outside are not so sheltered, because a lot of the people that come, they say they've never seen any of this trouble. They've never seen what's going on. And so everybody benefits. Everybody benefits from going there. But what I don't like is when everybody comes from the outside, builds a wall, makes a gated community, lives exactly like they would live in Dallas, and tells us we can't go on that land anymore, and starts making misery, you know. So it's bad. You know. Same story everywhere, though.
Everywhere.
Same story.
Martine, there was an interesting story. This is kind of a sidebar question. This week in the New York Times science section, there was a top-of-the-fold story about the ancient walls, a new Mayan epic.
I saw that. Yeah.
And what they've concluded is they found this place, San Bartolo, a ceremonial center in northeast Guatemala.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've uncovered is glyphs, basically hieroglyphs, that tell the stories about not only creation but about kingship.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wondered if you had any thoughts about that, or...
In what regard?
Well, kingship, to me, raises a lot of flags. I mean, you do ritual, but you certainly do ritual that doesn't have anything to do with people becoming kings and cutting off other people's heads.
No, not much
you're,
of that. No.
You're into the kind of ritual where people come together and heal at a spiritual level.
True.
And it just was sort of odd to me that these guys from Texas, from universities in Texas and Yale, came up with this sudden discovery that sort of supports the divine right of kings.
Well,
and we're already dealing with the divine right of kings
in
this country.
You hit it right on the head, friend. I don't even have to tell you. That's why I asked you what you wanted to talk about, because once we go there, it's what it is.
Well,
First of all, you have to remember the guys where they're from. First of all, they're all right-wing Christians. Half of the anthropology that's funded in Guatemala is funded by the Mormons. All right?
Oh.
Half of it. The other half is formed by these Texan Christians. Now, Natitlan, I can't go there anymore, because the two anthropologists that are there are anthropologists who are fundamentalist Christian anthropologists. And most of them are trying to discover the Mayan origins of Christianity. It's very bizarre, even though they have a cover of something else. That's why a lot of anthropologists have fled there. But the other thing is, that thing in San Bartolo is not new. That's been around for quite a while, actually. And second thing about kings, regarding the Mayans, old-time Mayans, there are so many layers of Mayan people. I don't know if you remember, I wrote a book called The Toe Bone in the Tooth. Okay, The Toe Bone in the Tooth is now being reissued in the United States under the title called Stealing Bonifacio's Roses. It's coming out next week. It's a beautiful new edition of it with North Atlantic Press. But The Toe Bone in the Tooth is the story that's in it nonetheless. And some archaeologists, some of these radioactive archaeologists, took that story and they started analyzing the toe bones and the teeth of all the Mayan kings that they found archaeologically. And they found that most of them, and these are the University of Texas again, they found that most of them actually did not originate in the Mayan area, that they were imported kings. And they don't know what to make out of that. Well, everybody knows what to make out of that, because the idea in the old Mayan cultures, there are many, many kinds of Mayan culture. One, they were not a people. They never were a people. They were a conglomerate of different kinds of people, maybe speaking different languages, living different ways in city-states, but never in those huge temples. They're spread out. Second of all, when kingships kicked in, when they did kick in, then what would happen is the king himself was the sacrifice. In other words, you are born into a certain, you might say, genetic clan whose all the male and female members were being groomed to be killed at a certain age in order to be put in the other world to help this world from that world as a transformed being. So nobody became a king of power. They became a king of sacrifice. This happened in Europe as well, happened in Greece, happened in Anatolia, 8000 BC, same story everywhere. All of a sudden, people get this idea of demonizing nature to some degree and stealing the neighbor's king to sacrifice him instead of me. That's when the power comes in. We got the one in the White House right now. So the point that I'm trying to get at is that these guys are glossing over thousands of years of all kinds of history to just try to make it look like there's one style or one age of being. This particular thing in San Bartolo is not over yet, because they still don't know everything about it and still haven't uncovered it. But there's many, many other sites that have similar situation with the glyphs. I still know the lady who unfortunately has passed away now, Linda Sheely, whose great work was their work that they've stolen and never mentioned a word of, I noticed in the article. She was also from the university. And another fellow who mysteriously did not mention either, who should be mentioned, David Friedel. But Linda realized that the glyphs at a certain stage were strange. They had the same glyphs in the middle, but different suffixes and prefixes. And I pointed out to her, I said, look, these are female words and these are male words, because even modern Mayan has male and female language. And it never occurred to her in her whole life, and start looking at all the glyphs like that. But at some point, it starts disappearing and starts homogenizing again, like English. And so there's some point there where the king becomes a thing of, quote, power, right? But the original Mayan, or I would say a doctrinous level of understanding, which was not always just Mayan, but something proto-Mayan that existed through all that age, existed past that age, and continued to exist after the Spaniards came and sat on everybody and other European entities and other Americans. So that the core value of what was originally Mayan got nothing to do with kings and hierarchies. Because what would happen, like everywhere else in Europe, a group would come in, sit on the previous group, the next group would come in. Like you got the Norwegians who are, you know, everybody calls Vikings, you know, but they weren't Vikings. You find all of their little trolls and all of their little people and all that. Those are the gods of the people they subjugated. And then they don't know nothing about the religion of the original doctrinous people of the Scandinavians, who were then subjugated by a bunch of Germanic people who were shoved out by another group of imperial people from the Mediterranean, from the original area. So this constant layering of peoples, and so that you have this king on top of this king. Now this king is a vassal. Now this king is a vassal. The other vassal is now a peasant. Jamming down till you get a very complicated system like Japan, which is the same story. Happened also with the Mayans. But you will find that each strata spoke a different language. Like the hierarchy of the Mayans at the time of the Spaniards were speaking a Toltecized version of Mayan, and the guys down at the bottom of the ladder, who are not perceived as being at the bottom of the ladder, but were perceived as the foundation that the other one was responsible to. So the king would have to be sacrificed once a year or once every 4 years or once every 800 days. They had several of them in line. And in order to keep the so-called, what the modern people call lowerarchies, alive, is not readily understood, you see, because the king himself had to chop off their little finger and wear that, and that's how you get invested, and then you wear this plug here, it was cut through your lip, and then you come to a certain maturity of time, you were sacrificed. When they stopped sacrificing the king of your particular own people and started borrowing from somebody else's people, then we begin what we know as modern history. Because that's exactly what started happening in Europe, and eventually we get to Christianity, then to rationalism, etc., 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 where you start exporting everything to somebody else, doing the custom, but not understanding its function. So this thing of the story of the creation, all that, that's all just a lot of... that's that same thing we started talking about today, where they're confusing and camouflaging the insistence of the present state of the culture into what looks like the trappings of science. It's just insane because, I mean, you have everybody all of a sudden trying to prove, you know, that this old Hebrew story that the Christians adopted is their story instead of that belongs to the Hebrews.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it belongs to. And so all these other stories have to be left intact instead of constantly trying to make them look like so-and-so's Genesis. It's like there was a very well-meaning man made what he called the Navajo creation stories and wrote it into one book. There is no such thing. There are 1,700 versions of creation stories by every different clan, different people, and they're all equally valid and they all belong to the people as a whole.
Right.
But you cannot make it into one. That necessity to have a oneness is the sickness itself. And when archaeology starts, you know, pandering to that sort of insanity, we're in big trouble, man, because it's playing into
right.
the politics.
We're seeing that all over the globe in the last, certainly
yeah.
last 20, 25 years. As far as I'm concerned, all we've done is wipe out cultures and history, ancient history, in order to supplant it with all this fundamentalism.
Yeah.
Martin,
yeah.
we're almost at the end of the hour, and I'm really sorry that we are, as I always am. But the other thing about all this that we're talking about with this excavation, the anthropology, archaeology, it's all marketing for tourism. It's a whole other industry ready to come up, and you and I know that.
Even worse than that. Even worse than that.
Worse?
Yeah.
Give me one reason.
Development.
Oh, development.
Like right now, Panama and Nicaragua is like getting totally developed
yeah.
by American developers.
Air conditioners. You got
yeah.
it. You are Martin Prechtel. You are doing a talk tonight at Looking Glass Bookstores, which we also fondly like to call the Laughing Glass Bookstore.
I like it.
Sending our fascists out for donuts of consciousness. So instead of knitting with them inside the house, we send them off for donuts, you say. I like.
More
I love
that.
This idea. And you will be there tonight at about 7 o'clock, sliding scale donation, $3 to $5. You will also be doing a workshop this weekend. Where's the workshop?
You know, I'm not entirely sure.
Okay, so people need to call Richard at 541-488-1192. That's 541-488-1192. Or go to floweringmountainalloneword.com. Martin, in about 30 seconds, any final remarks? Sorry to do it that way.
Oh, yes, it's always that way, you know, because we have love and we want to talk.
Right.
I just want to say to all the people of Portland to thank them for letting me come and always speaking my heavy words and all the things I have to say. And I'm going to make a little blessing in mine for everyone
thank
so
you.
They don't have to have so much pain and always look over their shoulder and that their dreams may become seeds to grow a time beyond their own. Shisha Hawa Kohila Tierka Tishel Kwashel to Salolop ki babe kiklo ami alav liqualavra wavio koko ahasha portland hyut ah kebu kanatar beer watch Marlina kanatatrarwa koa mundurchle to salolop in the bakelo amhonov lot nok no tribesha ho kohila havra kowavia. Sich no ochcha abalor titi ech tishel hanka kanaka natari biri watch kotse hal ho yu ruchile hanko honka tekovia kilam utsilam utsla bekalo na manatakasle mama honlov la oshle hul halamatu shield. And everybody wants to repeat, you say ki'il utsil utslach be utslach klo nimlach tak kaslimal maholov lo hoshlechu matyushil. Which is long life, honey in the heart, no evil, 13. Thank you.
Martine, blessings. Thank you for your spring ritual with us.
Oh, you're very welcome. Good to see your face again.
You too. Have a good night and a good weekend. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I want to thank all my listeners. It's been a great season. We'll see you in September. I'm going to go out a little Woody Guthrie. Kathleen Stevenson is right here, ready for Democracy Now!, so don't go anywhere. It's 1 minute before the hour of 10 or 11. You're tuned to KBOO, Portland, Oregon, 90.7 on the FM band, right here in Portland.
I'm just a lonesome traveler, the great historical bum. Highly educated, from history I have come. I built the Rock of Ages, 'twas in the year of one. That's about the biggest thing that man had ever done. I worked in the Garden of Eden, it was the year of two. Joined the Apple Pickers Union, I always paid my due. I'm the man that signed the contract to raise the rising sun. That was about the biggest thing that man had ever done. I was straw boss on the pyramids and the Tower of Babel too. Opened up the ocean, let the migrant children through. I fought a million battles and I never lost a one. That was about the biggest thing that man had ever done. I beat the daring Roman, I beat the daring Turk. Defeated Nero's army with 30 minutes work. I fought the greatest leaders and licked them every one. That was about the biggest thing that man had ever done.